delighted to welcome all of you, and a special welcome to the Ripon Pre-Law Society. Will the Ripon students please stand? Thank you for coming. The Ripon Pre-Law Society has come for a number of years, and we welcome you. Please be seated. Students are here with a program that we have sponsored over the years of inviting students, middle, high school, college, university students, that are interested in the law, or should be. We invite them to come to our oral arguments, and if they do come, or agree to come, they're given information about the case we're about to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to the case. They listen to the oral argument. And then after the second case, we'll meet with the justice assigned for the day to meet with the students. The conversation will be of the procedure by which we accept a case, prepare for oral argument, decide a case. The discussion will not be on the substantive issues of the case, and everyone's invited to join the students in this discussion. We're very pleased and proud to announce that this is a national award-winning program and has brought thousands of students into the courtroom. Does anyone in the courtroom wish to have a summary of the case we are about to hear? Marsha will give it to you, sir. Anyone else, raise your hand and we can get the summary to you. Having introduced the students to the court, I'm going to now introduce the court. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser, with whom you'll meet at noon. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. Having made those introductions, we will now take our first case, which is 2011 AP 1467 CR, State versus Anderson. Sally L. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, will argue on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Wellman.
Thank you, and may it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state, which is the plaintiff, respondent, and petitioner in this court. The state asked this court to hold that in determining whether to grant a new trial in the interest of justice on the ground that the real controversy was not fully tried, the court must consider the impact of the alleged error on the case and the verdict, and that includes a consideration of harmless error. In determining whether to grant a new trial in the interest of justice on this ground, the court considers the totality of the circumstances and whether a new trial is required to accomplish the ends of justice. It is our position that if the state can demonstrate that the error was harmless, then as a matter of law, it cannot be said that a new trial is necessary to accomplish the ends of justice. At the very least, it is a very relevant consideration that the court must take into consideration. It is not something that the court does not consider at all, as the Court of Appeals said in this case.
It's a relevant consideration for what? Discretionary reversal?
Yes. Whether a new trial is required in the interest of justice on the ground the real controversy was not fully tried.
So your position is the strength of the case is a consideration in the interest of justice analysis.
Yes. And it's not just the strength of the case, but the interaction of what the alleged error is and what the permutations and ramifications of that are. In the cases where an interest of justice on this ground has been granted, the court has articulated that it's in cases where, because it so pervaded the whole trial or misdirected the trial, that you can't tell what the difference would have been in trial strategies or evidence. And so it can't be determined. We don't, in that situation, we don't require the defendant to prove a reasonable probability of a substantial probability of a different result on a retrial. At the same time, we don't require the state to prove that it's not harmless, or that it is harmless. But it's a situation where you simply can't tell how it would have played out and what all would have happened. And that's not the situation in this case.
What is the I look at Vollmer, the Vollmer case, and I think that was cited by the Court of Appeals, which speaks of the interest of justice, and that the in the interest of justice, the first category, the real controversy not being tried. I see the Vollmer case as saying that that's not subject to, that inquiry is not subject to harmless error. Do you think the Vollmer case stands for something other than that?
I don't read the Vollmer case as saying that it doesn't apply.
This is the language from Vollmer, paragraph, I think it is 30. The first category of cases arises when the real controversy has not been fully tried. Under this first category, it is unnecessary for an appellate court to first conclude that the outcome would be different on retrial. Outcome being different on retrial is one of the several ways, of course, that we phrase our harmless error inquiry. So that's what I'm talking about.
I understand that, but I think there's a distinction between, because we do require for the miscarriage of justice prong of interest or justice, reversal, discretionary reversal, we do require the defendant to make that showing.
Yes, that's the second category.
Right, and what I understand Vollmer to be saying is, unlike that, we don't require that in the real controversy not fully tried. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the defendant may not be able to say, for example, in the National Bank case that we cited, the case was tried on the wrong legal theory. The trial court conceptualized it and instructed the jury, and all the evidence and arguments were shaped in whether there was a misrepresentation, a tort, and it should have been tried as a contract case. Well, in that case, the defendant's not going to be able to show a different outcome because everything is going to be different. We'd have to speculate. Well, if we'd been trying as a contract, we would argue this and they would argue that. So it's not fair to hold him to that. At the same time, the state probably, or the other side probably couldn't prove that there was no prejudice because it's such an unknown. It's similar to in the Perkins, I think it's Perkins, the true threat case, where the court said, well, as a matter of law, the threat to injure the judge or harm the judge has to be a true threat. There has to be something that the person to whom the remark is made on an objective, reasonable person standard would reasonably believe was an actual threat to harm as opposed to just political hyperbole. And that wasn't an element that was tried, so we can't know how it would have been decided on how the parties would have put in proof specific to that element. I think that's the kind of a case where you can't know, where evidence would have been different, arguments would have been different, instructions would have been different. But when you have a concrete error, if the state can show it's harmless, now the state may not always be able to do that, and it may be that there's a situation where the state can't do that, but it still wasn't so pervasive that we would say a new trial is required in the interest of justice. Whereas if, go ahead.
Well, first of all, the language in the statute doesn't have anything to say about what you're saying. Number two, the cases view it, the discretionary reversal, which is the same for this court as for the Court of Appeals, the language is precisely the same, as very broad. Three, we've put in on miscarriage of justice a harmless error test in effect. We didn't in the first. Now you're asking us to do that. Why?
I'm asking you to say that it is a relevant consideration.
I know.
I What we would like you to say, as a matter of law, if it's harmless, it can't. There's no justice in requiring a new trial in the interest of justice.
That's how I read your brief. And once you say it's irrelevant, consider a relevant, not irrelevant, a relevant consideration. How relevant? Does it overtake everything else? Is it worth only 10%, 20%? Why put it in at all when you have miscarriage of justice and going under that? I mean, the whole point is you got two prongs here, and you want to make one prong very considerably the same as the second prong.
I don't think it is the same, because in miscarriage of justice, we're putting the burden on the defendant to prove that there is a substantial probability of a different result on retrial. And what we're saying here is...
Who has the burden in discretionary reversal?
I believe the defendant has the burden to show that he's entitled, that his is the rare exceptional case where a new trial in the interest of justice should be granted. It's not quite the same burden because the...
But it's on the... But the defendant
is the one bringing the request.
In both examples. So we're moving closer and closer. Why is this important to the state? I mean, that today we have two cases, both involve discretionary reversal. Well, we don't get very many of these, right?
Right. Although, it's frequently made as a backup argument that really doesn't add anything to many cases. Why it's important in this case is because the Court of Appeals found the error was waived the objection to the instruction, which we think was correct because the objections made or the requests made at trial are not the same as what's being argued on appeal. And it was forfeited, and therefore the only way to get, and he was not claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. And so the only way to get to the issue and the only argument he was making on that was a new trial in the interest of justice. And we think the court was wrong on the underlying law of what the substantive law is on intoxication and insanity and prescription drugs. But setting that aside for a moment for discussion, once it found that the instruction was erroneous, it didn't go through an analysis, as this court said you have to in Avery, as to why does that warrant a new trial in the interest of justice? Why did it prevent the whole real controversy from being fully tried? And then it rightfully, I think, looked at all of the evidence, and of course this is an unusual case where the defendant has the burden of proof. So he has to prove his insanity defense. He has to prove two things, both that he had a mental defect within the meaning of the law and that as a result of that mental defect, he lacked substantial capacity to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. And the Court of Appeals looked at his evidence and said, given how contradictory his expert's rendition of the facts that the expert said led to him losing his control completely. It was contradicted by independent, objective witnesses. Neither this jury nor any other jury would reasonably believe his rendition of the facts, his assumptions of what factually occurred. And it's our position, though, if they wouldn't have believed his facts, which was the only basis for his opinion that the defendant could not conform his conduct, then they wouldn't have believed his opinion anyway, either, his ultimate opinion. In that situation, the court is saying the error was harmless. The result would not have been any different of that second prong. And, of course, we believe the result would not have been any different because, as a matter of law, he did not prove a mental defect because combining a prescription drug, even as directed, with voluntary ingestion of alcohol when the alcohol contributes to the condition is not a mental defect as a matter of law.
Ms. Wellman, why do you think the Court of Appeals spent time at the end of the opinion talking about what a weak case the defendant had? How does that fit in all of this?
I don't know. I mean, I find it baffling because earlier in a footnote when they were talking about our discussion of the facts, which they said, to the extent the state is really arguing this is harmless error, we can't consider that in granting a new trial in the interest of justice. And that's why we filed this petition for review, because we think the court can and must consider it.
Do you think the Court of Appeals followed our instruction in Avery?
No, absolutely not. They didn't even state the standard that it has to be a rare and exceptional case
Can I switch gears with you a little bit?
Sure.
I'm sort of curious about the jury instruction itself. And as I understand it, your position is, the defense position is, it was wrong. It basically took the issue away from the jury and told the jury there's no mental disease or defect here. Your position is, sort of, but you put the word and in there, and then it's not incorrect. And if you do that, it's still harmless. So far, am I understanding your argument?
You're understanding my point. I'm not 100% sure I agree with how you're characterizing what the defense is saying.
Okay. Here's what I want to ask you. And this is back when I tried OWI cases a long time ago. But I remember in those cases when someone would try to posit the defense, sure, I had some alcohol, but it really wasn't the alcohol that caused my impairment. It was the combination of alcohol and my prescribed medication that caused the impairment, and so you should find me not guilty. And in those instances, I would ask the court for what I phrased, and I think John D'Amato actually came up with this, the Godfrey instruction, which is City of Waukesha versus Godfrey, which is an old case from 1969. But the long and the short of it is, that case stands for the proposition that a person who consumes an intoxicant along with medication does so at his own peril. And that's a direct quote from the case. Why shouldn't we adopt that as the standard?
Well, I think I was not familiar with that case at all, or that, and I'm not real familiar with that area of law, the OWI law. But, I mean, that essentially is what we're saying that Gardner already says, which is, and it's our position, that if you take a prescription drug as directed, and that causes this mental condition that then causes you to lack substantial capacity to conform in the insanity context, if you take it as directed, that can be a mental defect or disease. It also, for underlying criminal purposes, can be a defense to the underlying crime under 939.42. But Gardner goes on to say, however, if you combine the prescription drug that you took, even if you took it as directed, if you combine it with the voluntary consumption of alcohol, then it no longer qualifies either as a defense to the underlying guilt phase or as a mental defect. We would say extend that to it, or as a mental defect. And I think that's consistent with Godfrey, as I understood what you said.
Godfrey is consistent with Madison versus Walker, which is a case from 1965, and Milwaukee versus Johnson, a case from 1963. You know, this isn't particularly new, and the logic is someone's chargeable with the knowledge of how their own limitations and own capacity, and if you choose to consume intoxicants and you're doing so while you're taking medication, you run the risk of being responsible for your own behavior.
Right, and we agree with that. And my understanding, and I don't really fully understand it, but as I understand the Court of Appeals decision, I don't think they were rejecting that concept. I think they were saying, but it's not a blanket across-the-board rule. So maybe in some cases it can, in some cases it doesn't, depending on the amount. And we disagree with that. We think it's a blanket rule. As a matter of law, now in the insanity context, we agree it should be limited to just to the extent that if the consumption of alcohol contributes to the mental state. So that, for example, the defense example, that if you're taking prescription medication, you take one sip of communion wine, then you're out. You don't get a mental defect. We'd say, no, your own, if you are relying on a temporary mental state as your mental defect, and the alcohol contributed to that, which the uncontradicted evidence of his expert was, I mean, if you buy his defense at all, it was that it was the four factors, and the alcohol was one of them. It was a contributing factor. Then that's not a mental defect as a matter of law. So to circle way back to our instruction issue, that's why, as I understand the defense, what the Court of Appeals and the defense were both saying was, what was wrong with the instruction using the word or was it prevented the jury from finding that he had a mental defect based only on the prescription drug. And we're saying he didn't under the facts of this case. A person could have under a different fact, but not where all of your evidence is you combined it with alcohol and that alcohol contributed to your mental defect. Then as a matter of law, that is not a mental defect under the insanity law. So the or in that situation, it didn't hurt the defendant because it kept the jury from going somewhere that we're saying as a matter of law they couldn't have gone. Worst case scenario, probably, if anything, it hurt the state because in theory it would allow the jury to go with the or, but there was no evidence for that. And is what was required or would have been the right choice in this case because all the evidence was he combined the prescription drug and alcohol, and the instruction would have been correct to say that.
Tell me what, let me put it this way, as I understand your argument, if you have voluntarily taken a prescription drug as directed, then, under the law, that gives you a defense and NGI, assuming you can prove it all. Okay. Mm-hmm. But, and I'm reading from page 16 of your brief, first full paragraph. But, if you take the, voluntarily take the prescribed medicine as directed, but you do it in combination with alcohol, then it is not a mental disease or defect, but NGI, and you would say it's not a defense. That's what I read your brief. And you stuck to that for a long time, but then you indicated, well, sometimes if you take alcohol along with the voluntary taking of prescribed medicine, you still can have it as a defense or NGI. So where did I mishear you?
Well, I think I you're trying to slightly to say if it contributes to the temporary mental state that you're relying on as your defense.
All right. So this first paragraph is not quite correct. Let's fix it so that I know exactly what the state views as a correct instruction.
What we would view as...
And if you have it in your briefing, we just pointed to the right page. That would help everybody.
I'm sorry. It's in the reply brief.
Okay. I've got that, too.
Right. At the beginning of the first page, at the bottom of the first paragraph, where it starts, the based on Gardner...
Temporary mental state brought into existence by taking of a prescription medicine as directed. That's the same so far...
Right.
Except you don't have voluntary, but that's okay. As directed, qualify a mental disease or defect. I understand that.
However,
if I got that underlined.
Yeah.
However, if the defendant voluntarily consumes alcohol in combination with the medicine, and the alcohol contributed to that temporary mental state, then the mental state does not constitute a mental defect for purposes of the insanity defense. So the instruction should read that, that should be the words of the instruction, right?
Yes. If we were talking an instruction outside the context of this case, we'd want to add the word mental defect or disease.
I understand.
And also the reason that we didn't use the word voluntarily taking a prescription medication is because...
But you do in the however sentence.
Right. Voluntarily consumed alcohol. Yes, we leave it there. You wouldn't have to have it in front of the prescription drug because if you're taking the prescription drug as prescribed or as directed, then it's not... Then you're taking it as you should. So the voluntary taking of drugs or alcohol in the current pattern instruction doesn't have to be there. I don't think it hurts anything, but it doesn't have to be there.
Oh, page 16, I should take out voluntary.
Only for the prescription. Do I have voluntary?
Yeah, you do.
Let's see.
So I just want to...
Yeah, it wouldn't have to have voluntary there because it may be a little confusing. I don't know if it would be or not necessarily.
Well, someone could make a legal argument about whether or not when you take a drug according to the direction of a physician, it's actually voluntary.
Yes,
right?
They could. So, yeah. And we're saying as long as it's as prescribed. Now, if you're taking it not according to prescription, then you would not qualify for the defense.
This is a case that involves the alleged taking of a prescription drug and the alleged consumption of alcohol. How would you characterize the relative relationship between these two things on the facts?
Yes. Well, all of the evidence of his own expert was his temporary mental state that he characterized as a mental defect was caused by four factors: the prescription drug, his underlying lifelong inability or difficulty controlling his exercising self-control of his emotions in provocative situations, his major depressive disorder, and his consumption of or ingestion of alcohol. And he said that was the cause of the mental defect. So that's why, you know, we think in this case certainly it's fair to include that language, because that's his own defense.
How much prescription drugs did he consume, and how much alcohol did he consume?
Well, we don't know. We don't know how much he consumed. We know that in the blood tests after the crime at the hospital, where he also injured himself and had to go to the hospital, he was a 0.15 on one test and a 0.76 on the other test, which is well over the legal limit. And his expert and the other expert both said, you know, referred to him as being under the influence in the doctor's reports. So, you know, we think there certainly was enough that it was a contributing factor, and that was his own evidence. If you take out his own expert opinion that he had a mental defect based on these four conditions, including alcohol as being a factor, then he had no evidence to support his mental defect or defense at all.
And he should have directed a verdict been granted? Is that your position?
Yeah, a directed verdict could have been given at that point. We also think it could have been given regardless, because there was absolutely no evidence that he took the prescription drug as directed, and that's a requirement of Gardner, and we think it extends to the mental defect. You have to take it as directed. He didn't testify, so we have no proof from him as to how much he took. He didn't tell either of the doctors that he was taking it as prescribed. He only told the police, "I've been taking this drug called Strattera, and it made me real edgy." He had a friend, a roommate, who said he saw him take some medication two or three mornings a week. We have no idea what it was. Even if you're willing to assume it was the Strattera, we don't know how much he took. He was supposed to take one a day. And most importantly, his own expert, when asked about it, based on him filling the one prescription for the 80 milligrams and not filling the second prescription, says he doesn't know how much he's taking. People are remarkably inconsistent and erratic about how they take their medication. A lot of people don't take one, and then they realize they haven't taken any, so they take a whole bunch. He said he may even have had a stash and been taking more than 80 milligrams at a time because he was taking more, you know, he had him to take. So we have no idea that he took it as prescribed.
Ms. Wellman, earlier in your presentation, I see the red light is on.
And oh, yes.
This might be a good...
May I respond?
Might be a good... Well, all right. We'll do it now. You indicated that you did not think that the error in this case was pervasive, so as to qualify as to pervade the entire proceedings. I think it would be very helpful. You then, a few questions later, made reference to a different error, which had to do with the jury instructions, but in kind of minimal effect in the state's opinion. I think it would be helpful if you would just take a minute to expressly define the error you're referring to and to take a minute to tell us why you don't think that error pervaded the entire proceedings.
Well, the error that we're referring to, the error that we see, is that it used the word or instead of and. And so if it had used the word and given all of the evidence in this case, the only evidence supporting his mental defect defense was that it was a mental defect caused by Strattera and alcohol and his depression and his emotional instability, that the difference to the jury between or and could not have made any difference.
Well, it's still stated in the negative, right? So he doesn't come out any better
right.
when you say and than he
right.
does with or.
If he were correct, and that in this case, If he were correct that the law is that he could have premised a mental defect on the taking of Strattera, regardless of the alcohol, even if it had some impact, the jury could just ignore that alcohol aspect of it, then the instruction did not clearly tell the jury that, because it said voluntary taking of drugs or alcohol is not a mental defect. But again, in this case, we don't think it warrants a new trial in the interest of justice because of the lack of evidence he had that he took it as prescribed, so he wouldn't have got, the jury couldn't have found for him anyway, and the lack of evidence and very great weakness of his defense on the second prong based on his expert's own testimony as laid out by the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
My red light is indeed on.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Wellman. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. William E. Schmoll, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. My name is William Schmoll. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, and I'm here today to speak for Daniel Anderson. The issue in this case is about whether a jury instruction that was given by the circuit court effectively violated Mr. Anderson's right to have the jury determine whether he was mentally responsible for the horrific acts of violence that he certainly committed. And that issue arises under specific circumstances, namely where the evidence showed that Mr. Anderson had a pre-existing mental disorder, where Mr. Anderson was taking prescription medicine lawfully, and that prescription medicine, according to an expert witness, had a horrible side effect, and where Mr. Anderson drank a disputed amount of alcohol, which, according to the expert witness, played only a small role in his ensuing mental defect. My only brief in the Supreme Court, the blue brief, devoted itself to demonstrating why the circuit court's jury instruction was misleading and erroneous. Today, in oral argument, I would like to take a slightly different perspective and explain first why the state's proposed rule of law that the Attorney General believes supports a harmless error claim is simply wrong. Second, I would like to give you the correct rule of law and explain why it's the correct rule. And third, I will demonstrate that even if this court were to accept the state's proposed rule of law, a new trial would still be required because of disputed facts that only a jury can answer. Now, I want to repeat the portion of the state's reply brief that the court referred to just a moment ago. It's at the top of page 2 of the state's reply brief. It reads as follows. If the defendant voluntarily consumed alcohol in combination with the prescribed medicine, and the alcohol contributed to that temporary mental state, then that mental state does not constitute a mental defect. That's the state's proposed rule of law, and it's wrong. And there are 4 different reasons why it's wrong. First of all, this rule conflicts with this court's previous pronouncement in State versus Kolesnichenko that we want to have case-by-case determinations. The reason why that's especially important where alcohol and medicine are involved is that it's common knowledge that different persons react differently to alcohol. In fact, the same person can react differently at different times in consuming alcohol. There's no way of simplifying that into an automatic rule that any consumption necessarily disqualifies your legal defense. It's really significant to me that the state has never explained where that rule comes from. That's just their conclusion. There's no reasoning to back it up. Second, the state's proposed rule is inaccurate and actually causes confusion rather than reducing confusion because it looks to the voluntary nature of the consumption. If the defendant voluntarily consumed alcohol in combination with prescribed medicine. Well, that's That's just inaccurate, because what's important is whether the ensuing mental defect, the ensuing mental state, whether that was voluntary. In ordinary and common usage, when I take my prescription medicine, I'm taking that voluntarily. That doesn't tell us anything. The question is whether the side effect that occurs after I have voluntarily taken my medicine, whether that was something that I should have reasonably foreseen and taken alternative action instead of taking that medicine. Remember, the test, according to this court's previous decisions for mental responsibility, is a test of moral conscience, whether the person in good conscience should not be held responsible. And that notion brings in the whole concept of foreseeability. Is the defect that occurred to you because you were taking medicine, perhaps with some alcohol, was it foreseeable to you that you would become homicidal or do whatever criminal acts you were charged with? Third, the state's proposed rule appears to completely ignore the question of whether the person had a pre-existing mental disorder, as Mr. Anderson did. Major depression, according to the expert witness. Why should some alcohol consumption, maybe even as little as one bottle of beer, why should that necessarily dominate a long-standing, serious mental disorder? That doesn't make any sense. Fourth, and most importantly, what's wrong with the state's proposed rule of law is that it violates the standard for legal cause, what civil lawyers call proximate cause. And what proximate cause means is that whatever conduct or event is in issue has to be a substantial factor in producing the result, a substantial factor, not just a contributing factor. What the state's test actually uses is what some people call butterfly causation. Let me explain that to you briefly. Back in the 1960s, a weather scientist wrote a scientific paper about predicting weather. And part of the title of that paper read as follows: Does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? And since that paper was written, I'm quite sure the scientist didn't mean that literally, but people often recite that butterfly's wings here cause a tornado there. I'm very, very skeptical that that's a true set of state of causation, even in the weather. But it's definitely incorrect in law, because our Wisconsin law is that a cause has to be a substantial factor, not just any factor. Now, what
so
then
do you
is
think that this is a correct instruction if we said on page 2, and the alcohol was a substantial factor in causing that temporary mental state? Would that be make this okay with you?
Justice Abrahamson, I've already drafted an alternate jury instruction that explains the correct rule of law. I'd like to read it to you.
Absolutely.
I brought 10 copies for the court and one for the Attorney General if you'd like to read along.
All right, well, first show it to the Attorney General and see if she objects. Assistant Attorney General. It's not in your brief.
No, it's not.
Well, appellate argument is always supposed to raise some new thing that's not in the brief, so we're not bored.
I always try to bring a different perspective to my oral argument.
Well, that's what all the books say. Very few people do that. Okay. You have access to it. You have any objection? All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wellman.
While this is being handed out, I would like to read both of the sentences aloud first and then to explain to the court where I got them from.
All right.
Allow me to read aloud first, please. A voluntarily induced state of intoxication which is produced by the consumption of alcohol or unlawful drugs or both is not a mental disease or defect. However, a mental disease or defect may be brought into existence by a combination of different factors, including the consumption of alcohol or lawful drugs or both, as long as the alcohol is not a substantial and predominant contributing factor. Now, let me explain. Where did I get this from? The first sentence is simply the rule of State versus Kolesnichenko. A voluntarily induced state of intoxication, which is produced by the consumption of alcohol or unlawful drugs or both, is not a mental disease or defect. I have no problem with that. The second sentence is a combination of the Court of Appeals discussion in State versus Gardner and the Court of Appeals discussion in this case. A mental disease or defect may be brought into existence by a combination of different factors. Shouldn't be anything wrong with that. Usually there's going to be a mental disorder involved somewhere, but there might also be prescription medicine, alcohol, perhaps even other things, including the consumption of alcohol or lawful drugs or both. There's the prescription medicine. As long as the alcohol is not a substantial and predominant contributing factor. Now, the last phrase brings in the notion of legal cause. It would have to be a substantial factor to disqualify the defense. And predominant because there might be more than one, well, there is going to be more than one factor every time alcohol is involved because there would have to be something else. And in this case, for example, where the expert said that the alcohol only played a small role in producing the mental defect, and the prescription medicine was by far the overwhelming cause, it just doesn't make sense. It isn't fair to say, well, we're going to disqualify your mental responsibility defense as a matter of law without the jury even considering it because of the small causal contribution of alcohol.
In this case, doesn't this instruction, based on the evidence that the jury had before it, cause the jury to speculate? I think what you really mean, at least as I read through this, is when you're talking about lawful drugs, you're not just saying you can take lawful drugs. You're saying they have to be taken as prescribed, right? I mean, there are a lot of lawful drugs, but you don't take 20 of them. You take it as prescribed. And there's zero evidence of that in this record.
I don't agree with that. The evidence was that Mr. Anderson was given a 30-day trial supply by his physician in June, the middle of June. He was observed by one of his acquaintances taking one pill per day, which is what the prescription provided. The witness saw him taking it 3 days a week. Then, approximately 1 month after he received the 30-day supply, he was back to get the prescription refilled, which I think supports an inference that he was taking one a day every day. So I think there's enough for a reasonable inference. But look at the other side. If the medicine is what was causing this horrible side effect of becoming homicidal, and he took less of that 3 days a week instead of 7 days, one wouldn't think that he should be penalized for taking less of the medicine that might make him homicidal. So I think we have to be careful in talking about as prescribed.
Well, under this reading, you could take as much as you want, however often or not, and so long as it's a lawful drug, it's blessed.
I think there's a jury issue is raised if a person takes more or less than they're supposed to. I don't think that disqualifies as a matter of law. I mean, when I take prescription medicine, sometimes I forget or I don't take it on time. Does that mean I should automatically be disqualified from saying I have a mental responsibility defense? No, I don't think so. Not as a matter of law.
What do you think of the Godfrey case that says a person who consumes an intoxicant along with medication does so at his own peril?
I would say that trying to draw an analogy to the different legal issue of operating while intoxicated is not apt. It's not an apt analogy. The reason is that the notion of whether a person's ability to drive safely is impaired is a completely different issue than the issue of whether a person has lost substantial capacity to conform his conduct to the law. In other words, I think you're comparing an apple and an orange. Now, it's conceivable to me that a person could be guilty of operating while intoxicated, as Mr. Anderson conceivably could have been in driving his vehicle to the scene where the person was killed, and not mentally responsible for that killing, because it is a completely different legal issue. On the other hand, it seems very unlikely to me that a person charged with drunk driving could prove that they're not guilty by reason of mental responsibility, because they would have to prove that their drinking of alcohol was not even a substantial factor in their act of driving. So, I believe I've set forth the correct rule. I believe the state's rule is incorrect, and as a result, their entire harmless error analysis is incorrect. But,
well, let me just go back to the state's rule on two. I appreciate your draft, but, you know, there's not only one way of reaching this. As I understand your issue, is that to eliminate the defense about the prescription medicine, the alcohol cannot be a substantial factor. I may have stated that wrong, and I'll state it this way. That consumption of a prescription drug will not give you an NGI if alcohol is a substantial and predominant contributing factor.
That's essentially what I'm saying.
So, however, if I take the state's position on two, if the defendant voluntarily consumed alcohol in combination with the prescribed medicine, and the alcohol was a substantial, you added the words and predominant, but if you're taking the civil one, you don't need predominant, it's substantial, contributing factor to the temporary mental state, then the mental state does not constitute a mental disease or defect for purposes of NGI. No good?
I think that's essentially what I was suggesting.
That's what I thought. And it's a matter of just, instead of saying contributed, which means at all or if any, you want to add contributed as a substantial factor.
Justice Abrahamson, I want to say again, though, I think you're confusing yourself by talking about voluntary consumption.
Okay.
What the voluntary really refers to is the ensuing mental state.
Okay. What I noticed in the briefs was the different use of voluntary. Was voluntary taking a prescription medicine, which is in the state's original brief, not voluntarily taking prescription medicine that is out on page one of the reply brief, and voluntarily consuming alcohol in two. And I just don't remember the cases on alcohol, but if somebody poured alcohol down my throat and then I was operating a vehicle, that may have been a good defense. It's irrelevant at the moment. I accept the fact that we have to look at the words voluntary.
Okay.
You just don't want any contribution, but it has to be a substantial factor contributing.
And I actually think it has to be more than just a substantial factor, as I suggested.
You are predominant.
Right.
Okay. Which is going further than the civil.
Yeah, but again,
because you can have several substantial factors,
yes,
in civil law.
Yes, that's right. The last category of analysis that I wanted to share with the court goes back to the claim of harmless error. And I would like to suggest that even if the state's proposed rule were accepted, the sentence at the top of their reply brief at page 2, even if that were accepted as the law, without a substantial factor, without a predominant contribution, and if the voluntary were actually in the right place, there would still be factual disputes from the record in this case that can only be solved by a jury, and a new trial would still be required. Harmless error review does not permit the appellate court to do fact-finding. The appellate court may not decide who is the more credible witness. The appellate court may not do that for the jury.
Counselor, is there anything in the record that would let us know whether the defendant knew or did not know about the intoxicating effects of alcohol or the combination of Strattera and alcohol?
First of all, there is no evidence in the record that alcohol would enhance the terrible side effect of becoming homicidal or suicidal. There's no evidence of that at all, much less that Mr. Anderson knew that such a thing could occur. I think we can infer, as a matter of the ordinary experience in human life, that he knew something about the intoxicating effects of alcohol. I mean, if he had drank enough of it. The statement that he made to the police that was introduced in evidence was that he had only had a few beers because he had to go to work the next morning. And that was consistent with what the police officer who arrested him and released him 30 minutes before the homicidal episode, that police officer of 10 years' experience released him because he did not appear to be under the influence of intoxicants.
Well, that was inconsistent with his blood alcohol at the later time of 0.175 at one point and 0.150 a little bit later.
The state's experts said 0.15%. But even if you accept that, Justice Rogenczyk, that only raises a jury issue. That is not conclusive on the issue of intoxication.
But what I'm looking at is, you know, you said that we had to focus on the voluntariness of the effect of what he ingested. Okay. So that's why I asked you the question. And it wasn't the voluntary taking of the alcohol, but the knowledge of the voluntary effect of alcohol. So that was the reason for my question.
My understanding of the record is that Mr. Anderson was never told by anyone, never given any written precautions, that Strattera medicine has a potential side effect of making him homicidal or suicidal. So he had no basis to foresee that. There was some written precautions that were given to him that the medicine could cause dizziness, drowsiness, there was another word, or faint-headedness, something like that, and that in conjunction with alcohol could be increased. That is the only notice that he was given, and the record does not even show that he had actual knowledge of what was in that written precaution.
Thank you.
There are three key factual disputes, even under the state's proposed rule of law, that can only be decided by a jury based on the evidence that was presented at the trial. Number one, and by the way, under the state's proposed rule, intoxication isn't even really relevant because all they're talking about is consuming some alcohol. But I think intoxication is relevant because it was relevant to the court in State versus Kolesnichenko. And it's relevant because if you drink enough to become intoxicated, then you should be able to foresee that you might lose control of yourself. There was a jury issue whether Mr. Anderson was intoxicated, as I just alluded to. His drinking was lawful. The amount was in dispute. He said he had a few beers. And apparently, one of the two blood alcohol tests was roughly the equivalent of one standard alcoholic beverage, in addition to which the officer who released him because he did not appear to be under the influence. I understand that those are disputed facts, but it's the jury that has to decide them. The reviewing court can't say, well, here's what we believe, and therefore it's harmless error. Second, more importantly, there was a jury issue, a factual dispute about whether Mr. Anderson's mental defect, the state of mind that occurred, was voluntary and foreseeable to him. As I've indicated, he was taking prescription medicine lawfully. If anything, he was taking less than he was supposed to be taking. He was not warned in advance that he could become homicidal or suicidal from taking this medication with or without alcohol. Instead, the written precautions, again, referred to dizziness, drowsiness, lightheadedness, or fainting. So even under the state's theory, the jury would have to decide whether what occurred in Mr. Anderson's mind occurred voluntarily.
Could I ask, Strattera is prescribed for what?
In this case, it was prescribed for what the clinic believed was ADD, attention deficit disorder, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD.
Is this a common drug?
Dr. Johnston testified that it's considered a third-line treatment, and actually his diagnosis, of course, was major depression rather than ADD. Third-line, he explained, meant that it's either too risky or not effective enough to be used as a first-line therapy. He actually, I think, referred at one point to amphetamines being a second-line treatment. When he was asked how many people get Strattera prescriptions, I think he said many, many thousands. Possibly it could be up to a million by now.
Well, that's really what I'm trying to get at. Does everyone who takes Strattera become at risk of becoming homicidal or suicidal?
Dr. Johnston testified that it's sort of like getting hit by lightning. It's very rare, but it happens every year. He noted that there are people who keep records of side effects to certain medication, and I believe his testimony was that there have been about 5 homicidal incidents by Strattera patients, about 100 suicidal incidents by Strattera patients. So if you compare that with hundreds of thousands of people on the prescription, it's rare, but he said it happens regularly. The last factual issue that lies in the record and can only be decided by a jury is, again, whether Mr. Anderson's consumption of alcohol was a substantial cause, a substantial factor in producing his mental defect. Dr. Johnston said it played only a small role, and the predominant cause was the Strattera.
But are you asking us to adopt a standard of a civil standard of a cause, kind of like if alcohol was a cause of his mental state, then he gets off?
If the alcohol was not even a cause, then it's irrelevant. It should certainly not disqualify the defense. If the alcohol consumption isn't at least a substantial factor in producing the mental defect, it's irrelevant and should not disqualify the defense, certainly not as a matter of law. Actually, Judge, Justice Ziegler, the test for cause in criminal cases in Wisconsin is the same as it is in civil cases. It has to be a substantial factor in producing the result.
The defense of mental disease or defect isn't that you show you had some alcohol in your system and then you've met your burden of proof.
Not quite.
It can't be that it's just a part of your mental state.
I don't know.
I mean, the burden of proof is on the defendant to meet, to prove this defense. And you aren't asking us to adopt a standard that so long as he had alcohol and something else in his system, that the jury should find him not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, are
No,
you?
It would always be up to the jury to make that determination. What we're talking about here is
it
when...
It seems to me you're really changing the standard through what you're asking. I mean, that's a big difference to say if it's a cause...
I'm trying to point out that this would be a jury issue. A jury issue, not... You cannot say as a matter of law that the defense is disqualified. If the jury were to find that just having a few beers was not a substantial factor and a predominant factor in producing the mental defect, the jury could find that he was not mentally responsible. That would be up to the jury, but they would at least have to find that it was a substantial factor at a bare minimum, or else it isn't even a cause. What I'm trying to say is that the jury did not have to accept the portion of Dr. Johnston's opinion that the alcohol was a causal factor. The jury was actually instructed in accordance with Wisconsin law that expert opinions are not binding on the jury and can be rejected. So the jury could have accepted Dr. Johnston's opinion that Mr. Anderson had a mental defect, which made him unable to conform his conduct to the law, but rejected the portion of his opinion that the alcohol played any causal role in the mental defect. It's all a jury decision. That's all I have. I have some time remaining if anybody has a last question.
You emphasize that the voluntary description should apply to the ensuing mental state as opposed to voluntary ingestion, so to speak. I note that the standard jury instruction in 605 has some alternatives to the standard instruction, and one reads, a voluntarily induced state of intoxication by drugs or alcohol or both does not constitute a mental disease or defect. Now, I understand the state's argument, it would be consistent with yours, if it is prescription, that maybe alters or influences what is meant by voluntary. In other words, it isn't that you're voluntarily taking a prescribed drug. Of course you are. You're taking it and putting it in your mouth. But prescription makes it, if you do it according to the state, vis-a-vis the directions, it is not then voluntary if taken as prescribed, generally speaking. But this language in the instruction, a voluntarily induced state of intoxication by drugs or alcohol, refers to the induced intoxication as opposed to the ensuing state of mind. Is the jury instruction incorrect in making?
No, I actually adopted that phrase, a voluntarily induced state of intoxication, in the first sentence of my draft instruction. I don't have any problem. I think that's correct.
Talking about prescription drugs there, are you?
No, there I'm talking about consumption of alcohol or unlawful drugs or both.
So you just can't drug yourself up with illegals or with alcohol.
Correct.
Alcoholic beverages and say, oh, I wasn't in my right mind or couldn't do it.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Thanks for pointing that out to me. Indeed, that is the very sentence that is your first sentence.
I think that's the case.
My red light is on. Thank you very much.
There are no further questions. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wellman?
Just to go back to what you just brought up, Justice Bradley, I think some of the confusion, maybe I'm just adding to it, but some of the confusion of the voluntariness is because in the pattern instruction there are two alternatives. One is the one that you just read about a voluntarily induced state of intoxication, and that was not given here in this case. What was given here was the second alternative, which was a temporary mental state which is brought into existence by the voluntary taking of drugs or alcohol does not constitute a mental defect. And that's the one I was trying to track in my argument, where I said what was wrong with our instruction in this case was simply it should have said and instead of or, and then of course, we had the discussion that that doesn't apply as written to prescription drugs taken as directed. So in response to the jury instructions that I was were provided at oral argument this morning, the suggested ones by the defense, I would simply say we don't have to deal with the first paragraph because no one here was talking about a voluntarily induced state of intoxication or unlawful drugs. This was only prescription medication. So focusing on the second one, I strenuously disagree that this is a correct statement of the law or that it would be a proper jury instruction. In the first place, we disagree with the language of or lawful drugs, because this was pointed out, the drug itself can be lawful. It may not be a controlled substance under the law, but it doesn't mean that you can just take it willy-nilly. What this defense is limited to is if you have a mental disease or defect brought into existence by the taking of a prescription medication as prescribed, and that language itself is found in Gardner for the underlying defense of intoxication. We also strongly disagree that it has to be a substantial or that if the alcohol is not a substantial or predominant contributing factor, then you still get the mental disease or defect defense or an
Say that last sentence again.
And we do not agree with the sentence that that it may be a mental disease or defect as long as the alcohol is not a substantial and predominant contributing factor. It doesn't have to be a substantial and predominating contributing factor. The defendant is the one who's relying on an insanity defense. There's no question he's guilty of all the elements of the homicide and attempted homicide. He stands guilty as convicted. Well, actually, he pled in this case, but there was sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt also to convict him. Now he wants to be held not responsible based on a mental defect that he's putting forth. He's putting forth a defect that he had a condition, a temporary mental state brought about by alcohol, the prescription drug, his own underlying emotional instability, and his major depressive disorder. When he puts forth that defense and he's saying it's one of the contributing factors to my mental defect, that's all that's necessary.
1% is enough.
As long as it's a contributing factor. Now, if the experts were to say the alcohol had nothing to do with anything, he could have been drunk as a skunk, wouldn't have mattered, he had a mental defect anyway, or there were conflict in the evidence, then that would be for the jury to decide.
Isn't this the very tension between your argument and the Court of Appeals? That is, you take the position, and the Court of Appeals refers to it as a kind of a blanket argument. You many times have said in your earlier presentation, as a matter of law, as a matter of law, as a matter of law, which essentially is the same, the blanket,
right.
the blanket approach. And the Court of Appeals is saying, no, with taking your approach, then it would not be necessary to allow a jury to reach a conclusion based on more specific facts, which the Court of Appeals is advancing, more specific evidence of the role of the alcohol, such as the amount and timing of the alcohol consumed, or the defendant's prior knowledge about possible side effects resulting from the interaction of alcohol and the prescription drugs. And so the Court of Appeals wants a more case-by-case basis, and you want a, as a matter of law, if the alcohol contributed, regardless of how much, even if it was just a little bit, then you're not entitled to the instruction.
That's right. That's our position because, one, that's what Gardner says. Gardner says mixing a prescription drug with consumption of alcohol does not constitute a defense. And the amount, and whether it was just a little bit, a lot, was he over the limit, all of that we're assuming is subsumed in the expert's opinion that he had a mental defect in the first place based on these four factors. So he's already taken that into account.
So his expert testified that alcohol was a contributing factor to his loss of control.
Absolutely. He said he had a mental defect based on four factors. These are the four factors. They all work together in combination. I just want to say one other thing about cause. As long as we're talking about cause, let's be very aware that the expert in this case never testified that Strattera causes or can cause or has ever caused anyone to become homicidal or to commit an act of homicide. The most he ever said was that there were five known cases of Strattera-associated homicide. Not caused by, associated. Now, he didn't define what that meant, but in another place in the transcript, when he was talking about domestic violence and the breakup of relationships, He pointed out that certain behavior is associated with the time for breakup. And he made it clear that associated does not mean cause. So we don't believe that the defendant is exempt or that he can have a mental defect simply because the alcohol didn't cause the mental state. By the same token, he did not have convincing evidence for the jury in this case that his prescription drug is what caused him to engage in this conduct. We also, finally, do not believe that it's the mental state that has to be voluntary. That's not the law of the insanity defense. Nowhere that I'm aware of have we ever said, or does the instruction or the statutory definition of mental defect or defense say that there has to be a voluntarily created, or the creation of the mental state itself has to be voluntary.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank Ms. Wellman and Mr. Schmall for their arguments today. We had two cases within the last month on MGI, and we haven't had one for a long time. And two cases today on discretionary reversal by the Court of Appeals. So we'll hear more about that. But I want to thank you for your arguments. That ends our hearing on 2011 AT 1467 CR State versus Anderson. We'll take a few minutes break so that the Griffin students may leave and other students are expected to arrive in the courtroom.